Blog Talk Radio.
Wow, I wonder how that happened. Okay, so the Brenda made a big mistake, and I just want to apologize. Let's just take a check. Today's Thursday. That means that we're doing Filmcology. Okay, next time I'm just going to be a little more careful, and I apologize. But right now, actually, folks, we are on Filmcology. I do want you to be happy, I mean, always, but today let's take a good look at a film and match it with some psychology, and let's just see what we get, what we can use with it, or what it can do to us or something. Sorry about that. I really do apologize. Okay, wait a minute. I thought we were there already earlier this week. Anyways, moving along. Today on Filmcology, we're doing Baby Boom. This is one of my absolute favorite films, probably for a lot of reasons, but Diane Keaton is one of my favorites. We all have, well, most of us have a actor that is in film somewhere that we really resonate with or that sort of speaks somewhere to our sensibilities, and she absolutely does. She just very intelligent woman, has her own sense of style and quirkiness, and it seems to me that she doesn't really make apologies for who she is, which I don't, I don't really advocate anybody making apologies for who they are. But if you do things that are sort of creepy and weird, then I advocate that you work on changing that. But otherwise, yes, just a wonderful actor. And this film, Nancy Meyer is the writer of this film, and she's written probably quite a few films that you've seen, and I think Diane Keaton's worked with her a couple of times. But the thing is, for this film with Baby Boom, which is sort of harkens to that whole thing about baby boomers and that generation that came out of World War II. They were born out of the World War II soldiers returning home, and how that huge supposedly surplus of babies showed up afterwards, which was actually just, I think actually for the baby boom generation, I think I might possibly be part of that generation. The baby boom generation, it actually stretched a little bit longer than I thought. And this isn't really so much for who they were, but it does have some representation about it. Let's see, yeah, because it says the baby boom was between the years of 1946 and 1964. So I made it by 1 year. I'm part of the baby boom generation, if you can imagine. And this seems a little bit strange, but so anyway, that generation, basically who we were, we looked supposedly at parenthood a little bit different. We tended to be more into our careers, and they claim, like on Wikipedia, that this was the wealthiest, most active, and physically fit generation at that time. Of course, when I look in the mirror, I don't see myself as the most physically fit. But maybe they were talking about another time. I can't actually profess to being there, but maybe it's because I'm at the end of the baby boom generation and I'm part of the next generation, which I think is Generation X, and they're a whole nother situation. But anyway, so you kind of have some idea of what group of people they're sort of talking to. And when you look at the subject matter of the film, psychologically it makes sense that we would be really entertained for it as far as the baby boomers. Somebody who's really into their career, children are a big wrench in the system. Psychologically, baby boomers just weren't, I mean, obviously they had children and they had their own perspective of it, but mostly the baby boom generation wasn't the kind that wanted to procreate like big giant groups of children. So this wasn't the generation that wanted to have like 10, 12 kids, essentially. Of course, there's always an exception. I have no children so far. So, yeah, obviously there's exceptions. But so you take somebody in this film, you take somebody who has no children, basically she's totally married to her job and her career, and then you thrust a baby. Okay, we do talk about unexpected pregnancies that happens, and you sort of have 9 months to deal with what you didn't really expect if you don't abort the baby. And no, I'm not talking about abortion as in you should have it or shouldn't have it. I'm not making those determinations. And I'm not suggesting that baby boomers were more apt to do that or not. That's not the whole point. Is this unexpected pregnancy is one thing. A baby that's dropped in your lap when you don't expect them and they show up before you have a lunch date and all these other things, it just spells disaster, at least career-wise and sort of personally for people who just have no sense of it. And the best way that they did this with this film is they show who the character that Diane Keaton plays is J.C. Wyatt. Love that name. J.C. Wyatt, even the name J.C. Wyatt, it's sort of like, it's the way that Nancy wrote this, she's really speaking a lot, even though it's sort of the generation, she's speaking a lot about women and sort of how they're treated, you know, how the world sort of views them. When you enter the movie, when the very beginning scenes of the movie, you see women in various careers on the streets of New York. You see the traffic cop is a woman. You see women in other situations on the street. And then you see the majority of tennis shoes or cross trainers, depending on what country you're in, where the women are all walking to work. And she talks about, the narrator talks about how 53% of the workforce are women. Now, before World War II, that just didn't happen. First of all, women didn't work outside the household. That was not something that generally took place unless it was a necessity. You either acquired a business because your husband died. Most times women, now this is, I'm doing real general because women who did acquire their own businesses and things like that were the exception to the rule. My great grandmother, not Mama Lenny, but my dad's grandmother, Aunt Belle, she didn't even allow us to call her grandmother. She didn't allow my dad to call her grandmother. We all called her Aunt Belle. Well, Aunt Belle had her own business. She ran her own store in Seattle, Washington. That was really unheard of, especially since, well, when you're any kind of mix of African-American in American society, any mix, you're never thought of as Caucasian. You're thought of as African-American, no matter how light you were. And she was quite light. Her parents were quite light. These are people that you could say high yellow, but quite honestly, they were beyond that. They didn't, you know, they just seemed to have a slight perpetual tan. They were very, very light. And some of them had blue eyes and all that. So my family, you know, yeah, a lot of them could sort of pass for white, as they say. But the point is, you had some black in you, even a couple of drops. You're African American. So for her to have her own business, to be African American and be a woman, that was unheard of. And as a matter of fact, there was an article about her because she was the first African American to actually own a Cadillac in Seattle. It was bizarre, which I thought, well, who would write an article about that? But they did. So we're talking about a movie that's actually pointing out how women actually did turn the tables on men. They not only joined the workforce when they started into the workforce during World War II, when women were needed to carry on the work here because all the men were sent off to war, women chose not to go back to what Nancy Myers described in the movie as the pink ghetto. I mean, the pink ghetto, I just totally love that. Basically, the pink ghetto is people who are just relegated to the household to do chores, take care of babies, cook the meals, and blah, 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 which, let's face it, I'm so totally not. But I don't care how well I could cook. Anyways, so here we start this movie with all these. One of the things she said was women were groomed to become, you know, the wives of something like the wives of doctors and lawyers. And she says in the movie, in the intro, but women, you know, went out to the workforce and became doctors and lawyers instead. So here we have this power executive, J.C. Wyatt. They call her the Tiger Lady because she just really is, she doesn't surrender fools, so to speak. She's extremely tough. She's all about, you know, where she can go with her career. They even talk about her relationship with the person she lives with. She lives with another investment banker, and they have separate but equal IRA accounts. So that she's even not willing to be any less than, even on a financial parity, with her lover. Okay, and then as we kind of look at, you know, who she is at work, she's a whirlwind going into work, and even before she gets into her office, she has people bringing her reports, and she's telling them what's going to have to happen. She tells the people that she's going to need everyone to work after on Saturday. Somebody says, well, I've got tickets to the Met that I've been trying to get for 6 months. And she looks at them like, are you actually telling me you're not going to be there? And they're like, I'll cancel them. And she sets up with her secretary to set up a good place for her and her partner, her lover, or whatever, to eat dinner at some nice joint somewhere, really nice joint somewhere around New York. She sets all this stuff up, and this is within a moment of minutes or even less than minutes. And then another secretary comes in to say that the head boss wants to have dinner with her, and she immediately looks at her secretary and says, cancel Steven, so cancel her lover. Just like that. And she goes to this power dinner, and her boss sets the tone further with the movie, and he says, yeah, we're trying to get this one account, and it's a major account, a several million-dollar account. And she's excited about the thrill of getting that account from some other advertising agency. And then her boss says, you know, I don't think about you as a woman. And she's like, okay. And She's like, he's like, how often do you work? And, you know, she's like, are you leaving the company? And then it's like, am I leaving the company? And he's like, no, just let me get this out. And he wants to express that he's a little worried that she's going to decide to have children and have a family, and then all of a sudden everything's going to change, and this major asset that he sees in her, because all she thinks about is her career, is going to be somehow taken away, and he doesn't want to invest in the quote-unquote woman if she's going to start behaving like a quote-unquote woman. And J.C. White clearly said, oh, no, if you think I'm worried about I wanting it all, she goes, I don't. I absolutely don't want it all. And that all takes place, and he assures her that she's being offered partner in this huge firm. So that night, she gets some kind of weird cryptic phone call, and it's about something being left to her, and she figures it's going to be a bunch of money because her family was worth money or something like that, and the connection was bad. They didn't know what was going on. Next day, she goes in to go. She has to meet someone at the airport to get this inheritance, which turns out to be this baby, because her distant relative from England died, and she's the only heir that's left, the only family member that's left to take care of this kid. So forget unexpected pregnancy. We're talking about unexpected motherhood altogether. Now, there are some people who may be close to that situation. For instance, if, like, for Bernie Mac, if you don't know who he was an incredible comedian, and he was just salt of the earth, good-hearted, handsome, just adorable man, and I could get choked up just thinking about him not being around. He's passed on, but one of the things that Bernie Mac did is he took on, like, instantaneously, his nieces and nephews of his, the children of his sister, because his sister was a drug addict and had a whole bunch of problems, and so he ended up being their parent. I mean, obviously, he's their uncle, but he and his wife instantaneously had these children. So that's another situation where you might instantly get a child, but even in that situation, you sort of have an idea that it might end up in that way, or they're going to end up in foster care. But this situation, all that was gone. Just all of a sudden you're handed a baby and it's like, there you are. Okay, she has a meeting with the person of the account she's trying to land, and we see all the hijinks behind that. Just psychologically, you even seen at one point she's thrust with having to have the baby in front of this client, and she explains that she's a Harvard graduate, or she graduated from Yale, one of the Ivy League colleges, and she doesn't have a baby. And the client looks at her like she's crazy, and she's holding this baby that's got diapers on and the whole bit. And I thought it was brilliant the way that they continued that complete culture shock, because she now, with this baby, even after this disastrous sort of meeting, she now has to figure out what to put on the baby. I don't know if you have ever diapered a baby or not, but when I was younger, before the Pampers, there were just safety pins and cotton sheets that you would wrap around, and you had to figure out how to wrap these babies up, which I used to be just traumatized by those when I would have to babysit somebody's baby, because I was just terrified I was always going to stick the baby. And that just, I think that there was some part of that actually almost made it in my mind like motherhood was not for me. because I would be horrified if I had stuck the baby. And I used to express that fear to the elders that were around me, and it's like, oh, you just do. And women were just elderly women. The women who were elderly to me, they were just like, oh, you just put your finger in there, and that way when you go to stick, you know, you're going to make sure you'll stick yourself instead of the baby. Okay, I would do that, but then the babies, the diapers would always be loose or whatever, and it was just a mess. Then they came out with Pampers, and if you, in the big, you may think Pampers are great now or Huggies or whatever, yeah, but when they first came out, half the time that thick stuff didn't stick. You'd go to pull it and it would rip off the plastic. It was another nightmare. So, I mean, I just so related to her trying to figure out which diaper to even get, because there's not just the baby diaper anymore. There's the little baby. There's the baby that's 0 to so many years. So it's just like the diaper aisle is intimidating, for God's sakes. It's even more intimidating now than when Pampers first started. And then we see her take the baby back to her co-op that she shares with her lover, and they, both of them are so like, what, a baby, what the heck is that, that neither one wants to hold the baby. He actually is scared by the baby, which then sets the baby crying. When he first gets home and the baby kind of taps on his knee or something, and then they, they try to feed the baby. And, of course, they make a nice, lovely pasta dish where they shave on some probably Parmesan, a little bit of parsley, whatever. They give her some kind of pasta, and they're serving it in this nice dish to this baby who's sitting there. What's interesting is the baby's sort of like, oh, that's a nice ball of something to play with. And then, of course, she starts throwing the pasta everywhere, and then we see them trying to clean all that up. Then they have to deal with the diaper. So she's trying to put the diaper on. The tape keeps coming off on either side on her finger, just like I had to deal with. And then she finally gets it sort of around the kid, and she thinks she's successful, and the baby crawls away from the diaper, just got free, which I have experienced. I don't know that I've ever been mother material. And then she finally resorts to electrical tape that she tapes the diaper on the baby. And if you think I didn't think about that many, many times, well, you're wrong. I didn't use electrical tape one time, but I did use masking tape. And I was just terrified the parents were going to come home and think, what kind of Neanderthal did we leave our daughter with? And they would have been right. And so then they sit the baby on the bed between the two of them. He's, of course, working because that's what they normally do. And then the baby gets a hold of the clicker. And in the film, if you watch it, it's really sweet how the baby is clicking the clicker, and then something would come on the TV. Well, you can actually, if you really look closely, you can see Diane Keaton watching the baby, and you can see her smiling as the little baby is watching I Love Lucy eating all this candy and hiding, stuffing it in her clothes because they couldn't keep up with the little factory treadmill for the candy and stuffing boxes. And the little kid is kind of, the little baby is laughing, and then at one point there is, she clicks the changer, and oh, the woman who does cha-cha-cha, I cannot remember her name right now, she starts doing her little hoochie-coochie, shaking her body dance on the Johnny Carson show, and the little baby actually starts shaking like that, which babies do. They're really good at just getting tuned in to the music, or they're tuned in to they're whatever they're watching. I love that natural connection to music and things that babies do. And you can see Diane Keaton just loving that. And then there's a political thing comes on that has to do with the news, and the baby starts crying. And so her partner's like, Elizabeth, I'm trying to get some work done. It's time for you to lay down and go to sleep. And you can tell that these people actually enjoyed working with these twins that played the babies. And I'm just going to do a quick side note really quickly. Last week, I guess the Today Show had shows on the babies that, you know, tugged at our heartstrings from 20, 30 years ago, whatever. And they had on some of these twins that were on these different movies, and they had on the twins that played on Baby Boom. And they, you know, beautiful girls, very beautiful young ladies, and they were talking about how there was a book signing that Diane Keaton was at, and they went to see it like a year or two ago, and they stood in front of her with the books to get them signed, and they had a picture of themselves being held by Diane Keaton, and she looked at the picture, and she looked up at them and said, no way. So it was really sweet because you know that they had a good time on this show, and their parents, I guess, had a good time. And she said that Diane Keaton signed their book real personally and hugged them and was really excited to actually see them again. They hadn't really seen her for, you know, 20-something, 30 years. So back to the movie. We see all these different things going on. She goes to work. She's trying to deal with getting somebody to take care of this kid. And then you see the issues of her having the child, deciding to have the child, which first she was going to give up for adoption. She felt really guilty about it, but it just, she had the, there was a clause in the contract where she could find suitable adoption if she couldn't take on the child. So she went to the General Adoption Agency, which I don't know if there really is one anymore, but, and the people that are going to adopt the baby were, okay, they were sort of religious, I'll say cultish, religious cultish type people, because they're moving to some sort of podunk city in the Northwest because of their pastor. And then the dad asked if they're sure there were no male babies available. He just wanted to make sure there were no stones unturned before he has to accept a girl and a girl baby. And then he says to his wife, well, is she all right for you, mother? And she says, oh, Lord, it's not a puppy mare or whatever, father, or something like that. That's what they call mother and father, which, okay, most baby boomers would just be creeped out by, and I was creeped out by, and Diane Keaton's character was creeped out by, and she hands over the baby, and she's getting, and the baby starts crying, and she's getting ready to leave. And it's interesting just how Diane Keaton's mind still isn't quite on board with the kid thing. She, as the baby's crying, she goes to say goodbye, and she just takes her hand, and she says, okay, then, take care of yourself. like another meeting she's leaving. And as she leaves and she hears the baby screaming and crying, which is one of my tear moments, she goes back for the baby, and the next time you see her, she's on the street walking, and she's emotional because now she's like, I'm taking on this situation, and she says to the little girl, don't expect too much, and the little girl just kind of goes, okay. I mean, she's just a baby. It's just adorable. Well, her boss and another partner come to see her to talk about this new account. And she, you know, because they're still trying to retain the account, and she has this problem. The baby won't take the bottle. they didn't expect the baby to be there in her office, and you can see her even playing as they walk in, playing with the baby. She's turned so quickly into this baby, you know, getting, you know, sort of connecting with this baby. Part of it we saw earlier in the film was that the baby got sick, and she wasn't sure how to deal with that. Well, here's the thing with children who get sick, and I can attest to this from another perspective, okay? Sometimes, you know, we have these kids, or let me just say for animals, I'm going to use my example for myself. You have them, and you're sort of like, yeah, okay, I got an animal, and they're da-da-da, and, you know, you got to take care of them. Or you have this kid, maybe you're not, she didn't really want the kid, but then the kid's sick, and she's up all night, you know, trying to deal with this cold and make sure she's going to be okay, and she's holding her a lot and rocking her and obviously trying to help her sleep and get comfortable and get medicine into her, and it does something to her, as you can see the transition as she's holding her in the quiet at night because her lover's off on a trip, and she's just playing with her fingers and looking at her, and it's just that transition from here's this alien in my house to maybe actually mothering the child. Now, I had the experience with my dogs. I mean, when I first got my dogs, my first dog, Pepper, was a shelter dog, and I the reason I got her is because I just couldn't stand the thought she'd be left in a cage by herself. All of her brothers and sisters, there were six in the litter, they were all taken, and I just, like, it just seemed such a lonely thing, and because my friend was getting two of the litter, and she was just going to be left alone, and it worked on me. And so I got her, and my dog Pepper has her sort of like, yeah, I'm here, you're there, and that's fine. We can kind of, you know, deal with each other. She was never one of those dogs that's like, can I be in your lap? Can I lick you and kiss you? She was never that way. She was always sort of her own person, and, you know, I respected her space. She sort of respected mine. She was never vicious. But, and I got another dog, and because I was going to go back to work, and I thought she should have someone to be around after she was kind of there for me. But then one day, she got lost. You'll love it. She got lost between the field, which is maybe 2 yards from the front door of my apartment. As we're walking from the field back up to the apartment, I have the other dog, the puppy. You know, he's right there with me, and run upstairs. And somehow Pepper was not right on my heels, which was odd. I don't know what happened, but we got up to the top of the stairs. I'm waiting for her. She didn't come up the stairs. And then you go downstairs, and she's not around. She was in the field. I'm calling for her, whatever. I was out of my mind all of a sudden for this dog that was sort of like, yeah, you know, I live with you and everything, but, you know, just don't be grabbing me and hugging me and all that stuff. She just wasn't that kind of dog before this moment, and I guess it affected both of us. She was lost, quote unquote, for hours, and I was bawling in such a wreck. My aunt, Lennis, she came over to come look for her. My mom at the time was going to be 84 this year. I don't know, she's probably 70-something. She offered to come over and go sorting through bushes and everything for her. I drove around the streets with the other dog. Couldn't find her. I'm yelling and calling. And Gaetano, my sweetie, he's like, okay, well, let's just offer a reward, you know, and post them so that people will give us this dog back. It was just that traumatizing. And I couldn't stop crying and bawling all day. My door was open. I just kept looking. We drove throughout the property only for one of my neighbors to come to my door. And he goes, he says, Pepper. And I said, I know she's totally lost. And I just a wreck. And he goes, She's at my door. Well, my neighbor's door was exactly the same. It looks the same. He actually lived in the same place up the stairs, only in the next sort of door entrance. So Pepper, the dope, went to the wrong door. Who knows why? It's not like she was blind. I think it was because another neighbor was coming down the stairs that she didn't really know. And since she took too long to follow in step, she sat up at his door, plastered to his door, he said, when he went up there, like, why won't you let me in the door? Like as if she thought we wouldn't let her in. And he couldn't even get her to come down the stairs. I had to go up the stairs in his building to get Pepper to just sort of recognize that she could come with me. She was really stressed out. And she saw Tyler, and then she came down the stairs, and they jumped around or whatever. After that, Pepper was actually closer to me, and I thought my heart had been ripped out. So, yeah, even when you think that you don't care for something, wait till they get sick. Wait till there's a possible problem. You know, change your whole life. And so here we are with Baby Boom. This woman is then treated like almost like a pariah, even though she got the account. And she has a little young upstart that she actually brought into the company who is a guy, and he's sort of doing these sort of underhanded things of sort of taking little by little the account away from her. And the people, the owner of the account that he's sort of taking from her is a guy. And at one point, her boss says he's taking the account away from her. And it, because she says that she wants him to go because he's trying to take over her position. And he says, well, yeah, well, their people actually are more comfortable with him. So we're going to give him the account that she got from another agency, this several million dollar account. And the boss says to her, I told you couldn't have it all. And it's like, I don't even know how many grandchildren I have, but this company's bringing in $200 million a year. And, you know, that means that I can't, you know, nobody can have it all. I mean, he's just like, my wife does whatever she does, whatever it is. And he tells her that he's going to take her and put her on the dog Ferber account, account for some dog food, after taking on this account that's the food chain industry. It's like one of the major accounts in the world. And she's like, she starts to cry, and I always start crying when she does it. She says, I can't go out there and say that I'm on the dog food account, you know, after being on the food chain account. And he said, well, I guess you're going to have to do what you have to do, which still infuriates me. You need to understand just what he's saying psychologically. This person isn't trying to retain this incredible resource, the Tiger Lady. He has already written her off, as in she's too soft to even be to count on. She's no longer an asset to this corporation that they were going to make partner with. I mean, because if you actually believe this is a resource, you're still going to try to be trying to work with them to keep them there, even though you may not want them on your most important accounts. You know that they're really valuable on any account. He's basically saying that's not so from a psychological perspective. And she realizes it. So she leaves. You know, you see her leave. And she had a file on some homes in the country in Vermont. And she decided that she's just going to buy this 62-acre home in Vermont that has all these, you know, has an orchard and it has a big lake and, you know, it's got a barn and a cow and all that kind of stuff. And so she basically leaves town with Elizabeth, the little baby, and they get an SUV and they traipse off to Vermont. And she just, I think she did that sort of out of anger without really thinking. But on a spiritual level, if we like pop into a little spiritual, psychological thing, psychological, spiritual, she's been cutting out these pictures of these kind of homes in the country for a long time. She had a whole file on it. And I believe that when you're doing that psychologically, your body, your brain, your spirit, something is already pushing you that direction. So I thought they played that out really well in the film. So then she's there, and her house, her farmhouse, one of the reasons it was available is because it had a lot of issues, and it was slowly breaking down. Like, the plumbing went out, the roof went out, and then something else happened, and she had to keep getting it fixed, and the situation, you know, gets to the point where she passes out because it's too much overload. When she finds out that her well is dry, and she says, "Oh, that's good. We could just, you know, go around and get the hose from the other end of the house and fill the well up." And the guy who's the plumber kind of starts laughing. He's like, "Ma'am, you're going to have to tap into the county line, and that's so many miles from here." That's really not funny. I don't know if you know anything about real estate, but when you live on a property that has well water and you want to tap into the public utilities water system, you got to pay, and I found this out from somebody who had to do this, you have to pay like some exorbitant amount for every foot to get tapped into that line. So we're talking a like massive amount of money. I mean, I think this thing, her place was something like more than 3 miles away or some crazy amount. And so when she wakes up from passing out, she's in a doctor's office, she thinks. Guy got a white coat on and da-da-da, and she's pouring out her heart like she wants to go back to New York. She's tired of Plaid, and she's cute, and she wants to get, but she misses her business and being the tiger lady, and she talks about how she hasn't had sex for a year, and it wasn't all that great, but when you don't have it, you really miss it. Well, in the beginning of the film, oh my goodness, there was a scene where her lover had like a face mask on, like the kind women put all over their face, a mask to, you know, take care of their skin care. And he asked her if she wanted to have sex, and she looked at him and said, "Really?" And he said, "It's coming off now." And so he goes and washes it off, and he comes back to her, and she goes, "Oh, you do still want to have sex. Okay." And so, you know, they kind of start kissing, and we see the clock, and the clock says 11:46, and then we look at them sitting up in bed, and the clock says 11:50. Oh my god, I for the longest time when I first saw this movie, I kept thinking, wait a minute, I didn't read that right. The sex went for 4 minutes, and her boyfriend says, "Wow, you know, that was really something." And you can tell she's extremely frustrated and bothered, and she goes, "Yeah." And they didn't even take the time to take their clothes off, because obviously why? I'm not going to get into the X-rated part of that, but yeah, so clearly this woman didn't really have any great sex, if you could call it sex. So to miss it, it's like when she makes that statement, but, you know, I didn't like it. But then when you haven't, no prospects of it, you really miss it. And then she finds out this guy is a veterinarian, not a human medical doctor. And she's upset and she's bothered and annoyed. But she started checking out because she's thinking, she finally starts using her wits. I got to get the hell out of here. And she starts doing research and she comes up with, you know, how she can, you know, do something with all these apples from her orchard. And she starts making baby applesauce, gourmet baby applesauce. And she ends up, you know, turning that into a cottage industry where she's making more than $1 million. And she's bringing in some serious revenue, and which I think everybody could do if they really spend a little more time and energy on what they need instead of, you know, what the celebrities need and all that other kind of junk. So then the movie basically, let's just fast forward, she ends up becoming a force in the food industry. And, of course, that other a client that she had initially won for her corporation, they actually want to do business with her or take over the business, this untapped market of gourmet baby foods. And so they court her. They ask her in for a meeting to try to court her and acquire her business. And she goes in there and she is presented with this incredible contract where she's making almost $1 million a year. She has access to a private jet. She's got, like, the apartment of her choosing. She's got the best office in the world. As an option, she still retains certain kinds of rights over the company. And they basically have told her, like, you know, we're going to take over for you because, you know, we can handle things that you can't handle and make your company really something. And so she thinks, you know, she actually is considering this whole thing. And, like, because they've now, the people that mistreated her are now at her feet, you know, begging her to come on board. And she realizes that she really loves being a mom to her little girl and doing her business in her home. And she basically tells them no and says that, you know, if anybody can bring her company nationwide, she can do it. And she really likes that she has a baby mobile in her office for her little girl to play with. And she also says that there's this vet, because she just started this relationship. She ends up, you know, falling in love with the veterinarian who was pretty cute, Sam Shepard. It was just pretty sweet guy, great playwright and all that, but, you know, he was a good-looking vet in the movie. So that is the movie, Baby Boom. It's about dealing with something that's unexpected. You don't know that you can deal with it, and how other situations actually help you rise to the occasion. It is also about, you know, issues that you've always wanted or you thought you would always want, but you haven't. Oh, I'm so sorry. There's people on. Oh, I'm so sorry. Let's get some people in here on the phone. I'm so bad about putting the number out there, folks. I didn't even see that there was a caller. Hello, caller.
Hey.
Boy, I still wanted to ask your opinion about some of these things in here because, well, you or even Nina, just the things about women, you know, that women from this film. Please tell me whatever things you were thinking to say. Go right ahead.
Boy. Well, lots of things. You know, I was on the other side of that. I have desperately wanted to be a mom.
Are you speaking into your phone?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Hold
you
on.
Sound so demuted.
Hold on.
Hello?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. So I was on the other side of the coin. I wasn't a career woman. I really wanted a kid, but I mean, I thought there was just such cute moments, the diaper scene, you know, but I learned a diaper when I was, I think, 8 years old for this woman, and we had the cloth diapers, and she told me, you know, if you're going to stick anything, you stick yourself, you put your finger there, and that was scary enough, but, you know, but the diaper scene was really, really cute, and how she fell in love with this baby, you know, that was really cool.
Yeah.
It was really... You know, and you can have it all, but it might look different than what you think it's going to look. So, you
exactly.
know, it changed her life. It changed her life, but it was so for the best. And I think she realized it, you know, that she just loved this little girl. And, you know, and it was just, it was very cool. I liked the movie. I watched it yesterday.
Yeah, you know, I really feel like this happens in real life. Literally, from a total psychological perspective, you could call it spiritual if you want to, but I believe that things happen in our life that actually help drive or move our life to
mm-hmm.
the next level.
I do,
and
too.
Most of us, because it's change, sort of fight that. It's a little bit difficult to accept the new situation. And I think that generally if you're feeling that way, then it probably means that you've gotten a little too stagnant in your life for your own good.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, I mean, even, you know, you and I talking about manifesting is something that we've talked about for, you know, probably most of our friendship. And it's interesting to me that she was keeping this little file and looking
mm-hmm.
at these houses.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She was
so
already
headed
there.
Mm-hmm. She was, whether she knew it or not.
She didn't realize it, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
It's the thought, folks, you know. First, you know, no matter what happens in your life, first it starts with the thought. And I don't know that she actually thought about having children, but I know she certainly thought about a different pace of life. I certainly mm-hmm. where she wanted to live. I mean, if she really wanted to live in a bigger and better posh apartment, why wasn't she cutting out clippings of those?
Right. Exactly. I think it was her
yeah.
heart. Her heart really wanted to go to the country. She mentioned it to her boyfriend, and he was like, you know, I forgot his response, but it wasn't positive, and like kind of like she was crazy.
He said that her in the countryside without a bullhorn would be scary, and she's like, oh, ha ha.
mm-hmm. Yeah. It was delightful, though. I really, really liked it. I thought it was very, very cute.
Did
you
feel there was anything about this movie that actually made you, did it actually make you think, I want to do something? Did it give you any sense of, you know, like a sort of jab, like, hey, you know, you could try this or you should do this? Or did it, or was it just entertaining for you?
Well, I was in the studio, so, yeah, I was making something, and it was, yeah, I remember when I first saw it, it definitely did that. This time it was...
That's what I mean, when you first saw it.
Yeah, the first time I saw it. And I think, when did it come out? What year did it come out? In the 80s, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was the 1980s.
Yeah, because that was before Child, and it was definitely inspired me. I thought it was really good. She was, you know, she had a lot of energy. Remember how when she'd get nervous, her foot would shake, her whole leg would shake.
She'd
start talking about money and her leg would shake, and they'd be like, what's that noise? And then she'd put her hand on her leg, you know. But, yeah, so, yeah. And, you know, and they made reference to her clock ticking several times. And, yeah, it was, you know, it was that whole – that it's true, though. Having it all is, you know, it's different. It's a different mentality to having it all or being corporate. And many women do that, the corporate. In this day and age, they do the corporate. I don't know how they do it, to tell you the real truth. It's just my opinion.
Well, I would think it'd be hard. Her boss Fritz was basically saying, you know, I can have it all because I have a wife.
Right.
So basically,
exactly.
Is what he's saying. But she can't because
mm-hmm.
she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really subjugating to women, and it just they played their characters well. I know for a fact that Diane Keaton and Sam Wanamaker, who played her boss, and
mm-hmm.
also Pat Hingle, who played the head of the food corporation company,
uh-huh.
that they were all really good friends. From my understanding, they were pretty close. And I've heard her talk about them. Sam Wanamaker died of cancer, and I think Pat Hingle finally died. He was a little bit older, but she was pretty close with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's their acting, and they're doing their acting parts, but they did them really well. It was just... it was really bothersome, that whole sort of, you know, girl-boy thing that was constantly being played out in that, because I have an issue about people making gender the issue. I don't think gender is the issue. I think it's just the issue is just who you are, whoever you
mm-hmm.
are. You're more than your gender. You're more than your color. You're more than your body shape. Your essence is what matters, and that's what we're dealing with in any capacity, whether it's as a coworker, as a lover, or as a friend. I'm not your friend because of the way you're shaped or the way you look or...
Oh, come on. You know it.
What particular equipment you have between your legs or, you know, whether you have antenna or not. none of that has anything to do with
right.
why I'm somebody's friend.
Well, it doesn't, but, you know, here's something that the way I see it, too, though, is that the corporate world was so, you know, it's kind of cutthroat, you know, you're the tiger lady, and then just because you have a child, you're not the tiger lady. But you know what? I don't think that was, for me, that wasn't necessarily true that she was the tiger lady. I think she enjoyed doing that, but I think her being progressed, I mean, with the baby, that pushed it. It pushed it. But I don't think she, you know, that's why she, you know, they offered her $3.5 million and then an amazing salary with all these bonuses and the jet and an apartment and blah, blah, blah. And she was in the bathroom and she's like, I'm back, you know, into the mirror, and she's all excited. And then as she's walking out, she's like realizing what she would give up by being back. And I think that she didn't want that anymore. You know, she didn't want that corporate stuff. I mean, some women do, and that's fine. I don't make any judgments about that. But I think her character was really... you know, just finding out that, hey, you know, this isn't what I want. You know, I can grow it myself or keep it small.
Well, see, and I think that that's the difference between their idea of the corporate, you know, whatever. I think that there's also, you're pointing out in my mind that, yeah, she's back. At some level, she could be back in their corporate regime, or she can be back in the same capacity in her own world, where she's
right.
defining it. See,
right.
versus
right.
the male
she's defining it.
Versus,
yeah,
yeah, and it's not. Yeah. And the only reason I say male defined because generally, from the corporate standing, that is a patriarchal sort of regime. In that way, and everyone sort of supports it and keeps it that way instead of it just, you know, corporate, as much as we like to say that there's no gender assignment, I think that's part of the problem. That word is actually more closely associated with a patriarchal type society a viewpoint of what's big business versus a matriarchal concept of big business. And I think that you can take skills of some of the greenest and most incredible companies that women are involved in or at the top of, and that are making bank, and they do things slightly different. And
they
it's
do.
Just a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having it all, it's like that statement to me is really defined by what you believe is having it all. You know,
exactly.
That man, he thinks having it all is doing everything completely, you know, away from his family and letting someone else deal with the, you know, the raising of his offspring and all their issues, you know, so that he can just be on top of a $200 million company. Whereas this
mm-hmm.
woman is deciding that having it all means, you know, my child is involved in whatever I'm doing, and she's always within arm's length. And yet
right.
I'm still successful. So it
mm-hmm.
was a really good comparison the way it was done. Although, this movie, when I first saw it, I was all over the place. You know, I was, you know, heart sick for her and how that was treated. And I just so wanted her to get vindication. That's a big thing for me. I have to
mm-hmm.
let it go someday. But the other thing is I have always sort of had this sense that I wanted to get away and have my own sort of secluded living space, because I just need time to think in my own space. I don't want to do it necessarily in the metropolitan. I love Seattle downtown and the metropolitan of it, but I also like being away from the fray of all the frenzy. And so when I saw this, it was just like, oh, man, I was in heaven going away to some Vermont farm. For a long
mm-hmm.
time, I thought I wanted to live in Vermont. But I didn't want to live in Vermont. I just wanted that seclusion from the city, but yet I could still be close enough to access it when I needed to. And
right.
the other thing is, I realized, albeit quite late in life, that I did want to have a child. It's something that's still in my mind. You know, maybe it'll manifest, maybe it won't, but there was a lot of things about Baby Boone that really talked to me. That as well as why do I feel the need to work for other people? You know, it's like, why can't I figure out something that is what I'm interested in? And, you know, I could do just as well on my own. And that's still with me to this day. My career as a psychologist is not to go work for some major corporation. I'm not saying it may not happen. I may end up working for a college part-time or something. I may work for community health for a little bit, but quite honestly, the gist of my career and the way I think about funding my lifestyle is to be independent, very much like the character in here. And I think that when I first watched this film, it actually made me feel like it's possible. I had those feelings before I saw it, but once I saw it, it's like, you know, it really is possible. So, and that's another reason I love, love, love this film. So, anyway, we're actually beyond time. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, time is what it is. But I don't know if anybody else had any last words. Nina, I thought Nina might possibly want to say something about Baby Boom. I know that she really enjoyed the film, but I guess if she wanted to pop in, she'd pop in. There's nothing else that I can really say about this film except, if you do feel like you're locked into your career, or you feel like your boss is telling you to do something that you don't feel ethical about, or it's not connecting to your heart and soul, you might want to watch a film like this to, you know, help you see that, you know, there are possibilities. There could be reasons why things aren't flowing so well at work, and maybe you should start taking a good look at what skills you have to bring to the table that you can, you know, you can exact for your future. Yeah, just start thinking outside the box for your life. And, yeah, everything that comes into your life that's unexpected may not necessarily be a bad thing. So that's my thoughts on the filmcology of this film. Oh, let's go ahead and go over the schedule real quick for folks that's coming up. And, okay, since Nina's not up there. Tomorrow we're going to have a Friday Traffic Jams with Lennis. That's at 5 p.m. Pacific. And then
Nina
on Saturday we have a special show with Nina, did you want to say something, or are you just trying to make sure we're on point?
I'm just making sure you're on point, and I was on earlier, but, yeah, you were busy, so that's okay. Yeah, the movie was great. I loved it. Good show. You got all your points through on that, and I felt exactly the same way you did about the movie, too. I was mad and sad and happy, and all those emotions came flooding through with this movie.
Thank you. Thanks for watching out for us. And so we'll pop on into Lydia's show real quick. 2 p.m. Pacific time, we have Time to Love with Lydia Pello, and she's interviewing Chrissy Vales. Did you want to speak to that real quick, Lydia? Or not? Okay. And anyway, Chrissy Vales is an artist and an illustrator, and she's done artwork for a lot of major stores that most of us probably know about, I believe Target, Walmart, or something like that. But she is an illustrator, and it might be interesting to talk to her or listen to her about how that happens, illustrating somebody's books and things like that. So that'll be definitely an interview to catch tomorrow, on Saturday, 2 p.m. And then on Sunday, we have 3 p.m. with psychic readings with Lennis. And I guess this is the last week, did she say, for the...
Yeah, it is the last week for the special.
So apparently
every
people
night caller.
Yeah.
Every night caller will get a free reading. And Lennis has said, if you guys don't call in, Brenda and I get the reading. So there it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting. Is she going to do our reading on air?
I don't know. She hasn't said. Might be fun, huh?
That would be something for her to think about, is actually do an hour reading on somebody, and so people can kind of see how some of that goes, maybe, huh? Anyways,
yeah.
It won't be me. Anyways.
Oh, I don't care if it's me, so.
Okay. Well, then maybe we should do you. We'll see if you catch it on Sunday. If not, then it's yours. Okay. So then on Monday, we have LNB Passage to Empowerment. That's at 7 p.m., and that show will be part 3 of our Power series on realizing your power from the female gender, the male gender, and this will be the romantic or the romance, power with romance, whatever, putting the two genders together, whether it's girl on girl, guy on guy, girl on guy, guy girl, whatever, however you put it together, the romance, how that manifests with power and how you can realize your power and retain your power in the midst of romance, you know, completely lose yourself into somebody else. So, yeah, pop in on Monday at 7 p.m. We might possibly have one or two of the guys pop in from last week. That would be nice. You know, we'll see if they call in. And let's see. Then Tuesday we have BYO Brilliance, and that's at 6 p.m. That's a bit of a special show for me. It's the historical brilliance of Donnie Barry. Donnie Berry is my mother, and she turns 84 years old the day before that show, so she has quite a lot of information that she can share with us. She grew up in the South, Shreveport, Louisiana, and then when she was 16 years old, she graduated. She graduated early. Smart little cookie she is. And she was whisked off to the North by my grandparents. And the family, a few of the family migrated to the North, which is where I was born. And then she can probably talk to some of the differences between the South and the North and educational habits and the way people treat you and how things have changed in the last 80 years in the world. Okay. And then on Wednesday, we have In the Studio with Lennis at 7 p.m. She talks about hot topics. She goes over things with celebrities, sports, and different newsworthy items. And then, let's see. And of course, the reason I didn't see it is because I didn't have it up yet. But folks, actually, because it's just summer and I'm trying to lighten things up, I will get it posted. But we're going to have two shows, actually, that we're going to look at on next Thursday. And the two movies are, and the reason I'm going to have two movies is because they actually are based on sort of the second one is based on the first one. The one movie is called Bringing Up Baby. That's the first one. It's back with Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn. It's an oldie but goodie. And then What's Up, Doc? By Peter Bogdanovich. It has Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal. And that actually is sort of based on Bringing Up Baby premise, the Howard Hawks film. So the reason I'm doing them together, and we're going to talk about them and sort of the differences and some of the psychological differences between one era and another, is because they're basically the same movie, but, you know, seen through different actors and whatever's eyes. So anyway, I hope you can tune in next Thursday for Bringing Up Baby and What's Up, Doc? They're both really funny. And since we're lightening things up for the summertime, we're just going to have a few more uplifting comedies somewhere I'm going to throw in a nice creeper movie in there because you can't have summer without a drive-in monster movie, okay? So, next week, What's Up, Doc? And Bringing Up Baby. And that pretty much is it for Filmcology, folks. I will get my music right. I'm surprised Nina isn't yelling at me yet, but she probably will when I hang up the phone. And we will join in with I'll have the link up and everything tonight so you guys can get to know a little bit more about those movies and see some of the trailers. And thank you, everyone who is listening on archive or you connected through your podcast or however, Facebook, however you got in there. Thanks for joining us on Filmcology. That's film and psychology. You know, get out there and see what film can do for you. All right. Bye, everybody. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Thanks, Nina.